kind of personal power that Jesus had. He didn't have the authority from God to bring favor and grace. That's really what Jesus had. When God says all the fullness dwelled in him, the fact that that character of Jehovah, God, was in Jesus, representing to the people what God was like. Remember when Jesus said to Philip, "I've been with you so long, and you say, show me the Father?" Yes, Jesus said in Mark 10:45, "For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for men." That was Jesus' focus, to minister in his life, and to bring not just messages, but to bring a new era in for those who would follow him. Jesus taught, not just taught, but he taught with authority. It wasn't a law that he was reiterating. Jesus said, "I've not come to destroy the law, but to fulfill it." And he expanded on the law, and he challenged those who were so-called authorities. Yes, it was great. Intellectually, Jesus could challenge any of them. Jesus also taught and was moved with compassion. And as he moved through the crowds, we see how greatly he felt for them. Jesus healed sicknesses. He healed diseases as well as teaching. But Jesus didn't heal all disease. He didn't remove all the sorrow. You know, there are many times we face the challenges of others saying, "Well, if you are such a devout Christian, why aren't you out there doing service work for all people around the world?" And I use the example of Jesus. Now, Jesus did not heal everyone. He did what he could. He moved within just a minute part of the human race because he realized that that was not the time for the primary healing to take place. Jesus didn't remove all the sorrow. It is true, Jesus was never in the presence of death except his own. Every other time he was in the presence of death, he removed that death and brought them back to life. The resurrection was undoubtedly the greatest teaching that he presented. Remember Paul, when Paul was brought before the authorities, Paul was wrestling with the authorities. We read in Acts 17:18, "And certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics, intellectuals of that day, encountered him, Paul. And some said, 'What will this babbler say?' Others, 'He seems to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection.'" Notice how he links those two. Luke links those two for us. Jesus and the resurrection. Certainly the core of his teaching and his work. Life from the dead. That is, as we talked about yesterday, the ultimate work of the ransom. The whole purpose for it. Resurrection of the dead. Brethren, it is the heart of our message. As we said, a unique message with two salvations that others do not encounter or see. The awakenings from the dead that Jesus did in his day were really a preview of his ultimate work. Yes, it was to attest to his messiahship, but more importantly, it was to call attention to the fact that this is something that will occur in the future in a much different way. Not as awakenings, but as a true resurrection. And so, when we look at what is the heart of redemption and that ransom, it's an awakening from the sleep of death for every member of the human race. And really, a first opportunity, as Joe talked about yesterday in the study, this is really the first opportunity anyone will have to get out of the weakness that they carried from Adamic sin and be associated with Adam's sin. The chance to ultimately attain to what God intended, a state of perfection, and preparing themselves for eternity. So those awakenings from the death that Jesus had, they were undoubtedly, in my mind at least, and I could be wrong, the greatest of Jesus' miracles, and a preview of the comprehension comprehensiveness of Jesus as the Lord of life. The four Gospels that we read, of course, give us a very rich picture of Jesus' miracles. And I know many of you study these Gospels in your studies, personal or class studies. Let me talk just for a minute about these four Gospels. Luke, in the first chapter, the very first four verses, Luke states his reason for writing his Gospel. What he acknowledges in his Gospel, that there are other Gospels already in existence. But he said he was putting the things in order so that people could understand. Now John, we know, wrote after the fall of Jerusalem. Masada was down. Subversion was coming in to the Jewish teachings about salvation by knowledge. The Gnostics were invading Jewish faith. And John and Christianity, John wrote to counterattack this. In fact, someone said that the first three verses of John are his premise, and the whole last remainder of the chapter is proving those three points. At one time, I thought Mark was the first gospel written, and that's the popular view by, I hate to use the term, Bible scholars. You are the Bible scholars. But by those who claim authority over understanding the writings that compose. But in recently, there have been discovery of Papias, writings of Papias in the 2nd century, wrote that Matthew composed the oracles in the Hebrew language, and each one interpreted them as he could. So I really do believe that Matthew wrote first to convince the Israelites that Jesus was the Messiah. He was the Messiah of prophecy. Hebrew, remember, though, wasn't a language that was in a lot of use in Jesus' day. We know Jesus spoke Aramaic, and we'll see that as we go on with this discussion. But there are many Jews that didn't speak Hebrew at this point because they had been in captivity so long. And the Gentiles, of course, didn't speak Hebrew. They only knew Greek. So I think Matthew wrote from that standpoint. Mark, I think, wrote for the Greek-speaking only interest. He stresses Jesus as a servant of God and man. When we talk about that, Jesus coming to minister, John emphasizes this part. And John then adds little details. Mark adds little observations and emphasizes Jesus in that capacity, as I mentioned, as the authority over all the elements of the earth, and the authority to overrule the fallen earth. And we see that repeatedly in some of the miracles that he records. I'm going to focus on really one miracle or two, but there are four that illustrate this fact from the book of Mark, found in Mark chapter 4, verses 35 through the end of chapter 5. And you'll note, these are four miracles that do appear elsewhere, but these four miracles are listed pretty much in order in Mark, in this Mark chapter 4 and 5. Those four are one, remember Jesus calms the storm on the sea. When he's going across the water and he's asleep in the boat, he calms the storm. The second one, when you get to the other side, Jesus heals a demoniac that comes yelling out at him, Jesus, you know, Son of God. Then he goes back across and he heals, encounters a synagogue ruler saying, come to my house, my daughter is dead or dying. And Jesus, on his way there, heals a woman who had an issue of blood. And then the fourth one, Jesus raises that ruler's daughter. Those are the four highlights that I want to look at just because it shows this idea of Jesus as the ability to overrule the things of the earth. And it affirms Mark's picture of Jesus as one who can overrule those things in the fallen earth. When Jesus calms that storm on the sea, the disciples were beyond themselves. Who is this man that even the waves and the wind obey him? Jesus had the power over the natural world. That was demonstrated in that miracle. Then remember, he encounters this man with the demons, or perhaps two men with demons, when he gets to over across to Gadara, and he comes running out, and he actually has a conversation with the demons. This shows you, and they had to obey him, I think this shows us that Jesus has power over the supernatural world. Third, on his way to the synagogue ruler's house, he encounters a woman with an issue of blood. Jesus showed there he had the power over disease, which plagued man. And finally, in raising the synagogue ruler's daughter, he showed us he has power over death. Those four elements encompassing the problems of man in this age, in this world. Jesus had the authority to overrule any of them. I'm going to focus basically on number four because of the desire to look at really Jesus as the Lord of life, the resurrection, the authority he had, the power over death, and what that pictures for us. Remember, he said those miracles were pictures of Jesus' greater authority. But I'll touch on the other issue as part of this, where he heals the woman who had a blood flow for a long period of time. So we read in Mark 5, 21 to 43, I'm just going to highlight part of this. This is when he crossed over after he healed the demoniac. He crosses, says, now when Jesus had crossed over again by the boat to the other side, Capernaum, a great multitude gathered to him. Now this was unlike what he encountered in Gadara, where they said, get out of here, we don't want you here. When he took those demons and put them in the swine and they all went over the cliff, and he said, we don't want you here. He got no great reception. But here the multitude gathers around Jesus. They're very popular looking at him. It says, behold, one of the rulers of the synagogue came, Jairus by name. I wonder why he says Jairus, why he counts this. I think when we find the mention of a name of someone that Jesus encounters, I think those people eventually became disciples of Jesus after he died. And I think that's why Mark and others oftentimes will have the name Malchus, remember who Peter cut off the ear in the garden? I think he was one of the temple guard. And I think if any time those names are mentioned, it's a signal to us that they became something special in the church, at least part of Jesus' followers. But Jesus was thrown out of Gadara, but he was welcomed here in Capernaum. They were glad to see him again. Jairus was the head of the local synagogue. Now, why would he come to Jesus? The synagogue rulers, as we know, they really could care less about Jesus. Was he a believer at this point? I don't think necessarily that he was. But if we go over to the book of John in the fourth chapter, verses 46 to 50, we found another encounter where Jesus came. It says Jesus came to Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine, and there was a certain noble, it was not mentioned his name, a royal official, whose son was sick at Capernaum. The nobleman said to him, sir, come down before my child dies. And Jesus merely said to him at this point, go your way, your son lives. So the man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went his way. Now, I think perhaps this man, Jairus, knew him. And so Jairus had heard about Jesus healing this man's son, and he went to Jesus seeking that same thing for himself. Now Matthew, in his ninth chapter, records this event, and Matthew 9:18 says that this occurred while Jesus was at Matthew's house for a banquet. When did Jesus go to Matthew's house for a banquet? Remember, it was when he called Matthew. Matthew says, Matthew, I want to dine at your house. Matthew was the tax collector. So I think this happened early in Jesus' ministry. We find it happening before he sends out the disciples on their first initial visit to go out. So here a man from Jairus comes from the synagogue. And here he said, please come. He said, my daughter has died. Past tense. When we read the book of Luke, it says, Luke 8:42 says that the daughter was dying. And Mark 5:23, when we read that, it says she was at the point of death. Well, which is right? I think it's explained by saying that Jesus really, or Jairus, left his house in desperation. His daughter is dying. It appears Jesus has just come back, and he rushes to go see him. While he's on his way, the servants come to him And Mark tells us those servants came to Jesus, or came to Jairus and said, Don't bother, she's already dead. You won't make it in time. Matthew himself kind of omits this section, omits the drama as is the case, because he's writing merely for another purpose. But I think that's the explanation. He leaves when his daughter's dying and says, maybe if I can get there, Jesus can do the same thing he did for this man in the room. Just say the word. But they say, she's already dead. So Jesus sets out, says, I will go to your house. But during that journey from Matthew's house to Jairus' house, Jesus is interrupted. He's interrupted by a desperate woman. Now, there's a lesson in this, kind of a sidebar lesson for us, brother. Jesus was on his way in a hurry, I'm sure. Jairus' son is dying. And he undoubtedly wants him to get there quickly. But Jesus is interrupted along the way. We'll see in this incident, a very important incident. But Jesus takes the time when he's on a mission to be interrupted. Do each of us do that? If you've ever been on a mission, we heard somebody talk about it yesterday, Bob, I think someone talked about it. They're doing all this stuff. Suddenly you get interrupted by someone, or I guess it was Peter. Yes, Peter talked about that. And you find out that the Lord's got something else for you. You say, well, I just really don't have time for this right now. I got this to do. Don't ever shun those away, because they're very important. Jesus, as busy as he was, took the time whenever he was interrupted. This woman was not just sick. She, it says, was financially drained. She had been to the doctors who couldn't help her, and she had spent all of her money. And she was a social outcast. She had had this issue of blood, and if you read back in Leviticus, the 15th chapter, anyone who had this was disbarred from meeting with any of the other Jewish people. She couldn't go to the synagogue. She couldn't go elsewhere. She was a social outcast. Very similar to what we'll find with people who come to Jesus, I think, in the kingdom. When he begins his work, those who have been sick, those who were drained of all the resources, and those who were social outcasts, they will come seeking Jesus right away. Jesus is on his way. If Jesus sets up that kingdom, there will be many that will pour into it very quickly, I think. What did this woman want to do? She reached out to Jesus. There's a hymn I like a lot. It's called, Reach Out to Jesus, He's Reaching Out to You. And you can almost see that. You can picture this. I love the pictures of this incident because it shows this woman says she reached out to touch the hem of his garment. And what happened? Did Jesus know she was there? Mm-hmm. Now, here's what it says in Mark 5, 27 and 30. When she heard about Jesus, she came behind him in the crowd and touched his garment. Jesus immediately, knowing in himself that power had gone out of him. An interesting statement. He turned around and said, who touched my clothes? I think this incident is there to help verify for us the important truth that we believe happened. It suggested that each time Jesus healed or did some type of miracle, it took something from him. So that when he died on the cross, he was totally spent. He died very quickly because his energy was gone. How did that energy go out from a perfect man? Here we're told that this idea of virtue or power going out of Jesus with each miracle, each time he healed someone, even though he knew it would cost him something, still did. Brother, that's the whole principle behind the sin offering and laying down our lives. Yes, our energy and a small way goes out of us. We lay our lives down for the brethren. But that's the whole purpose for us to do that. Just as Jesus was totally spent, that's what God wants us to be at the end of our walk. Be totally spent in service. Now there are a couple other incidents where something like this is recorded. And I'm just going to talk briefly about them. In Acts, the 5th chapter, verses 14 and 15, it says, and believers were increasingly added to the Lord, multitudes of both men and women, so that they brought the sick out into the streets and laid them on beds and couches, that at least the shadow of Peter passing by might fall on some of them. Now, Luke doesn't tell us whether that actually would heal them, but the implication is there, that it might happen. We have a similar statement about Paul in Acts 19:11-13. Now, God worked unusual miracles by the hand of Paul, so that even handkerchiefs or aprons were brought from his body to the sick, and the diseases left them, and the evil spirits went out of them. Two strange passages. Now, Jesus gave the word, and people were healed. But here we have this idea that something mystical or magical around, I don't want to use the word magical, something mystical around this, did those heal? But we know that the Catholic religion has made a big thing out of icons. You know, incidentally, the Pope said yesterday, the new Pope, he's not calling the Shroud of Turin a relic any longer. He's just calling it an icon. Significant change, yes. A significant change in his sort of perspective. But I think this is what the problems we have, you know, when people say, if we could just have a St. Gretchen told me a story when one of her sisters, sister or brother?
Sister.
Yeah, had problems with her eyes. Her mother would take the, you know, a relic from one of the saints that was supposed to be the saint for eyes and lay it on her eyes at night, hopes that it would heal. So this, I think, this is not what is meant here, but the, no question that the apostles had an unusual power, that they were given through that Holy Spirit, the gifts of the Spirit in their day, to perform some of these miracles in ways we don't necessarily understand. But for Jesus, the touching of that virtue going out of her, out of him, from the woman touching him, was an important point. The principle behind it is that Jesus gave his humanity. His humanity was being drained. It was not important to him. It was being drained by the miracles he did. His sacrifice on the cross was enormous. But he suffered daily, brethren, as these his compassion for humanity was so great to heal those that were with him. Perhaps, I don't know, just a suggestion, perhaps there was something similar with the apostles. We read here, I don't know. It certainly is true with Jesus. And just put it before you, if you have a suggestion or a thought on that, I'd certainly appreciate hearing it. But should, doesn't that signal to us, brethren, that our sacrifice should cost us something? It's not spare time sacrifice. It's a sacrifice that costs us something of ourselves, just as it did with Jesus. Well, let's go back to the story. It says, then he came to the house of the ruler of the synagogue and saw a tumult and those who wept and wailed loudly. When he came in, he said, why make this commotion and weep? The child is not dead, but sleeping. And they ridiculed him. Well, of course, they said, hey, she is dead. This idea that Jesus said she's not dead, but sleeping. Now, Jesus came to Jairus' house, and he found that the funeral preparations had begun. Jesus used this term, sleep, to refer to death. Now, of course, he did that one other place, remember, in the incident of Lazarus, but there he reversed it, because he said, she's sleeping, and he said, well, if he sleeps, does good. And then he says, Lazarus is dead. So it wasn't as though Jesus didn't think she was dead, that she was just sleeping. It's just like with Lazarus, where he said, Lazarus is sleeping, dead. But what did he mean? There in John 11, he said, our friend Lazarus sleeps, I go that I may wake him up. And then he says at the end of verse 11, Lazarus is dead. In the Jewish Talmud, which is the writings of the rabbis, there's hundreds of occurrences of this term, when he slept, that signifies the time of death for those that were mentioned by them. You know, our word cemetery comes from a Latin word, a late Latin word, coimeterium, which means, from the Greek, coimeterion, which means a room for sleeping. And from the word coimen, which means to put to sleep. Jesus, of course, didn't deny. He didn't deny the reality of death in Lazarus' case. He's not denying the reality of death here, but he is implicitly assuming that that death will be followed by an awakening. And when we talked yesterday about that's really what the ransom did, it turned sleep, or turned death into sleep, and implies an awakening. Jesus was previewing, remember, the great works that would come in his kingdom. There's no question that death is real and painful. Any of you that experienced it with parents or children or anyone, you know the pain of death. And Jesus isn't negating that at all. And when we talk about them sleeping and being raised, we're not negating it. It's a terrible thing to have someone torn away from you. But he's saying, this 12-year-old girl, I'm not calling her back from heaven. You know, this is with Lazarus. Billy Graham, one time someone asked him a question. Why did Jesus weep when he, it says Jesus wept when he was going to go to Lazarus? And Billy Graham says, well, he wept because he knew he had to call Lazarus back from heaven. So it just shows you lack of understanding of this issue around the sleep of death. But he wasn't bringing her back from that. He wasn't bringing her back from any condition of consciousness. But he's going to renew her with the experience of life. Not eternal life, but this is an awakening. You know, it's the same thing we have for the kingdom. They're being awakened. There's no guarantee at that point that it's going to be eternal life. But it's going to be an opportunity not to go into the grave again. An awakening from sleep for her was to the forces that had been suspended. That's the nature of resurrection. It's bringing back those to the forces that had been suspended. It's the five senses, it's the ability to have. But that's not the resurrection itself. None, in Jesus' day, no one was truly alive. Remember what he said to someone that said, I can't follow you now, I have to go bury my father? What was his response? Let the dead bury their dead. He knew that no one was truly alive. And no one has been truly alive since Adam's fall into disobedience. When he said that in Luke 9:60, let the dead bury their dead, Jesus was verifying that man in his condition currently is not what he used to be. True resurrection removes all the mental, all the moral, all the physical degradation, and elevates that mind and body to perfection. That's true resurrection, and that's why we say it only comes at the end when man has made the progress. That's when the true resurrection comes. Jesus was the first fruits, we're told, of resurrection. Even though those others were raised, it doesn't say they were resurrected. It says Jesus was the first fruits of the resurrection. 1 Corinthians 15:20. The first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. There it is, those Jairus or Lazarus, Jairus' daughter, they weren't resurrected. They were awakened. But Jesus was the first fruits, truly, of the resurrection. And also in Acts 26:23, he would be the first to rise from the dead. Only way we can explain that is to understand this is a different kind of awakening. This is an awakening to perfection of spiritual life for Jesus. And so it will be with the church, but not for man until they're raised in the kingdom and can truly achieve that kind of life. Jesus' miracles were a foretaste only of a worldwide scale of his kingdom to lift man out of death. All those who would be willing, all those who would say, yes, I want to do this, I will obey. Brethren, we think, especially today, on Easter Sunday when the world celebrates the resurrection, it really doesn't know what it means. That should awaken us from any slumber of sleep we have to a new life with energy, with devotion around this idea of promulgating Jesus and the resurrection of the dead. To be faithful stewards of the grace of God. Jesus' redemption work was so comprehensive and so wonderful. We have the spirit of a sound mind if we come into Christ. We love what is right and noble, just as Jesus did. And so those things should motivate us to sacrifice our own lives. Well, one final thought on one issue here. As you read these, you find a coincidence. Maybe it's a coincidence. A coincidence that the woman had labored under this issue of blood for 12 years. How old was Jairus' daughter? Told in the very last verse, she was 12 years old. Give her something to eat, he said, for she was walking around. I don't think it's placed here by coincidence. I think it's, again, a foretaste of what we can expect in the future. What does that number 12 represent? I know you may not read these well. This is really more for me than for you. But the number 12 occurs over and over in dealing with God's government. There were 12 tribes of Israel. There were 12 pillars erected at Mount Sinai when the children of Israel camped there. There were 12 pillars erected in the Promised Land. There were 12 statues of oxen held up at the water basin in Solomon's temple. 12 princes of Israel brought gifts to the sanctuary on 12 different days. 12 apostles. 12 gates of the New Jerusalem. 12 foundations of the New Jerusalem. And the trees of life in Revelation 22 will bear 12 kinds of fruit. I think it's representative of God's government in the kingdom. What does that do? God's government brings the dying outcast life. First, as the woman reached out to Jesus, she was healed from the thing that had made her an outcast. Spent all her money, she had nothing left. Nothing left. And she came to Jesus. That's the picture, brethren. She came on her knees and touched his garment. That picture of consecration, those who come to Jesus in the kingdom and say, I'm ready to obey. I'm ready to abide by the rules. I want to have life. That's the beginning for them in the kingdom. And what's the ultimate? The ultimate is Jesus restores them to life, just as he did with Jairus' daughter. Now it's true life. It's not just an awakening, but he says, give her something to eat. What does he say? Come and eat freely of the trees of life. Those who finally are awakened to true resurrection in that 1,000-year period of the kingdom. Now feast on everything that God has for a perfect mankind. I think it's a beautiful picture we have described here in Mark of the ultimate work of Jesus in the kingdom. We're told after these four incidents, Jesus returned to begin the ministry in Nazareth. His disciples followed him, and then he sent them out. But the people question, where did he get all these things that he was doing? The wisdom, the miracles by his hand. Jesus' miracles demonstrated his power, and they demonstrated more his care and compassion. And now he sends out his disciples for the first time with no support. And he gives them the same authority, the authority, the power to heal. But he had to have them understand that it had to be tempered with compassion. They had to build their faith by the example of Jesus. So, brethren, for us, what does knowing Jesus as the Lord of life do for us today? We've been justified through faith in Jesus. We've heard that call to glory. We've already passed from death to life. We've experienced that life. Our new nature is being developed now. And it will be perfected in the first resurrection. We will be after those afterfruits, after Jesus. Our faith today is tested by deferred hope. The world doesn't get deferred hope. You know, it's spend now, pay later. All the things people can't wait, have to have it now. Brethren, our hope is deferred. We see all the things going on us, but we are asked to wait. It's the test of time that we must endure. That's the endurance of our faith. But Paul tells us, your life is hid with Christ. No one understands. But God and Jesus do understand. So, brethren, as we think about this Easter Sunday, and what the world celebrates and doesn't know, Let us remember this scripture. It should permeate our hearts. Philippians 3:10 and 11. That I may know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings, being conformed to his death, if by any means I may attain to the resurrection from the dead.